The show of support from you, our valued listeners, has been overwhelming. You've already raised enough to pay for most of a year's worth of episodes for the show. If you can afford a little something, please click the link to the GoFundMe in the show description. Thank you so much. Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes Chris Duncan to kick off our Let Metal Roll mini-series with a look at the documentary Get Thrashed. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. Or should I say metal roll or something? I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and I'm joined by Chris Duncan, who's a guest lecturer in music at the University of Iowa. And we're going to continue the...
Iowa State University.
My bad. So that's in Ames?
That is in Ames.
Yeah, Ames. I knew it. All right. So, we're continuing the We Dig Metal Evolution series that I started with Alexi and Eugene. Alexi and Eugene basically tapped out once we got to the 90s on metal. So I drafted in Chris, and we're going to pick up, follow up the Thrash episode that we ended with a discussion of the documentary Get Thrashed from 2006. So they'll take the discussion a little bit deeper than we got with Metal Evolution episode, whatever it was that we covered Thrash. So Get Thrashed, it's a pretty workmanlike documentary, I would say. Like outlining it, it was super easy because they show their work, as it were, with the sections. Like they'll just put a thing on the screen that's an obvious section header. What's your take on the overall ambiance and quality of the documentary?
I felt like it was more directed at metal fans. If I recall correctly, Get Thrashed was sort of like a movie release, whereas the Metal Evolution, it seems pretty obvious that was like for a VH1 music documentary audience, whereas this is more directed at metal fans specifically.
Yep, I think that's fair enough. And they get right into it. And the first thing they point out is the regional nature of the thrash scene, that you had LA, where you saw Metallica, Slayer, and Megadeth all emerge. But that's a little bit deceptive because Metallica moved to San Francisco pretty quickly, or to the Bay Area pretty quickly. Slayer stayed headquartered in LA, but basically played a ton in San Francisco and toured nationally. So it's a little bit of a distortion. And also Cliff Burton came from the Bay Area and joined Metallica and pulled him up there. The second big hub, as you probably figure by now, is the Bay Area, San Francisco. You had Exodus come out of there, which was originally Kirk Hammett's band. Kirk Hammett, of course, the lead guitar player for Metallica on most of their albums, or all of their albums. But Dave Mustaine was the original guitarist before that. And you also had Testament come out of the Bay Area, and Death Angel, and a whole ton of other bands. Is that all right? Well, we'll talk about San Francisco in a little bit more. And then the third hub is New York and New Jersey with Anthrax and Overkill. But that's also where you had Metallica's early album label Megaforce, and Metallica spent some time up there and kind of played Pied Piper. So Metallica influenced the San Francisco scene, then they go to New York and New Jersey and influence the East Coast scene. So kind of definitely a Pied Piper, as it were, for thrash.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. Their move to San Francisco was basically the Cliff Burton decision. They wanted Cliff Burton. I think he was in a band called, it was either Panic or Trauma. And their bass player at the time was a guy named Ron McGovney, who I think currently is an insurance salesman in North Carolina. when they moved to San Francisco, it was for Cliff because that's where Cliff wanted to move. So I feel like a little bit of the San Francisco scene influenced them as well. And if I'm not mistaken, it was Anthrax who recommended Kirk Hammett to them as their guitarist over Dave Mustaine. And we can get into that little breakup a little bit later. So I don't know. I feel like the New York scene had quite a bit of influence on Metallica as well. And when you look at a guy like Lars Ulrich, he's Danish, obviously. And I think that, you know, sort of the European flavor of music that he was interested in also, I mean, you could hear it all throughout their music.
Yeah, absolutely. And the movie then segues pretty quickly into a discussion of the influences on Metallica and the whole thrash scene in general. And it all boils down into Wobbum, basically, the new wave of British heavy metal, the worst subgenre name of all time there. But, you know, you got your Iron Maiden. Def Leppard came out of that scene, but Def Leppard quickly morphed into more of a glam pop metal band and isn't really relevant for the thrash bands. But, you know, Motorhead was arguably part of that scene. Some people classify them as kind of precursors of New Album, but there were definitely influences on that. And the most straightforwardly combining punk and metal of any of these groups. But you also had Diamond Head and Venom, Blitzkrieg, Tigers of Pantang, Tank, Mantis, on and on. And I think the really important part of New Album, and, you know, Judas Priest also has to be in this discussion because they preceded the new wave of British heavy metal, but they also adapted to it and thrived throughout it and kind of became popular in the States at the same time or a little bit earlier than Iron Maiden and Def Leppard. And even the Scorpions out of Germany were kind of part of that mix of being big in the late 70s and crossing over more mainstream in the early 80s. But definitely, I think the most important thing about New Album is that is the moment when heavy metal self-identifies as a subculture, where bands are like, we are a metal band. It's no longer bands like Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple that are like, we're just hard rock, baby. You can call us heavy metal if you want, but we don't like it very much. But bands like Judas Priest and Iron Maiden were self-consciously loud and proud heavy metal bands. And that, to me, is probably the most important influence of New Album on everything to come.
You know, there's really a lot there, too. Like Motorhead also, they're another band that really hated the label heavy metal. Lemmy always fought against the label that they were a metal band, and he always felt they were more rock. And I could see why he would say that in their sound, but, you know, he never really declined the royalties from any of the metal covers. So, you know, who knows, maybe he was more okay with that label than he let on. And, you know, Judas Priest, I mean, like Judas Priest is why all of us think that leather jackets are cool, because, you know, obviously their lead singer, Rob Halford, is gay. I mean, no one knew that at the time. But
some of us knew that, but it wasn't publicly admitted.
Was it like a Luther Vandross situation or a...
It was the same guy who beat me up for saying that pro wrestling was fake in eighth grade beat the crap out of me 4 times for saying that Rob Halford was gay. But I just kept going back to the well because it was obvious. I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. But these guys were so homophobic, I just couldn't help throwing it in their face and getting that thrown back. But let me jump in and drop our first song. This is Jump in the Fire, not from Kill 'Em All. This is Metallica, of course, but this is from the No Life to Leather demo with Dave Mustaine, who co-wrote the track and plays lead guitar here. So this is Metallica's Jump in the Fire from No Life to Leather. And that was the original Four Horsemen. I'm talking about Metallica with James Hetfield, Lars Ulrich, Cliff Burton and Dave Mustaine on lead guitar doing Jump in the Fire off the No Life to Leather demo, which is what got them, brought them to the attention of Megaforce Records and got their career kickstarted. But yeah, back to Nawabum. Yeah, Lemmy was older. I mean, he was in Hawkwind. He roadied for Jimi Hendrix. He played in a beat group in the 60s. So he's a general earlier generation, but Judas Priest was definitely loud and proud metal. Iron Maiden was definitely absolutely loud and proud metal. Diamond Head, Venom certainly was consciously taking things to a greater extreme. So that's the first big influence, on Metallica and Slayer and Megadeth. But the other thing that was in the mix at this time was punk, and not just punk, but hardcore punk. And starting with the Dead Kennedys in 1979, a lot of people don't consider the Dead Kennedys hardcore. And I can see that looking back. They seem more like first generation punk, but at the time they were clearly something new, something more extreme, and very much helped kickstart the hardcore scene. The other two big mainstays of the beginning of hardcore are Black Flag out of Huntington Beach, California, and Bad Brains out of initially Washington, D.C., and then New York. But you also had these British bands that were the Class of 82 hardcore bands or punk bands. And this is Discharge, The Exploited, and GBH are the big three that influenced the incipient crop of thrash bands we're talking about. And it wasn't like that. It was still kind of controversial for metal guys to be into punk at this time. So it would tend to be things like Jeff Hanneman and Slayer would be really into the Dead Kennedys and Black Flag, and he would be sort of preaching and playing them for Kerry King and the rest of the guys in Slayer. And similarly, you know, I think Lars Ulrich might have been the most into hardcore of the Metallica guys and is spreading the word to the others. But the fact that those bands had upped the ante as far as speed and tempo and aggression so much kind of put it in a position where the thrash bands had to respond to that. And also Discharge probably had the most direct musical influence because of their use of what they call the D beat, which becomes a standard thrash metal beat. Of course, Fast Eddie of Motorhead was, you know, put the blast beat on and the double bass drum beat on some Motorhead tracks in 1979 that influenced this whole thing. So, but until Metallica comes out on the Metal Blade compilation, the Metal Massacre tape cassette compilation, and hit the lights is on that track, and it's Metallica with two T's, and it's only James Hetfield and Lars Ulrich, not even a band at this point, just a couple guys in a studio or, you know, practice space making a demo. But that kind of crystallized it, and immediately people realized there was something new here, and this was a new standard in heavy music.
You know, there's really a lot there. I should have interrupted you. Like, it's the Dead Kennedys are also from San Francisco too, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yes. Yep. Absolutely.
God. Silicon Valley gave birth to Metallica and the Dead Kennedys and Testament, and now look at it. It's wild how much that place has changed in just 40 years.
Yeah, it's a whole different, different thing.
It's sort of like, do you even think something like that could exist in the United States today? Like, where, if thrash metal was to be reborn, or something like thrash metal was to be reborn, where are you getting that sort of environment to have, you know, the sort of like the open and progressive attitudes towards music, and quite frankly, anti-establishment attitudes. I mean, you know, you listen to like Motley Crue or any of the you know, like the Police, bands like that. Metallica is a pretty big repudiation of music such as that. And you know, like you mentioned that their first demo was just James and Lars. I mean, those are two guys that met through an old free weekly called The Recycler. I mean, I don't even know, like, if they have free weeklies in like cities like New York and Los Angeles these days.
Yeah, and that's a bigger discussion. And we've wrestled with that on the show a few times, like Simon Reynolds' Retromania book which we're going to do a What Have We Learned follow-up on pretty soon. Yeah, that's an open question. I think the internet totally kills it. But at the same time, this early 80s period is one of the first times where you see musical scenes that are distributed geographically. So that at the same time, you've got hardcore punk sprouting up in Los Angeles, San Francisco, DC, Detroit, Austin, Texas, you know, scattered all over like that. At the same time, you've got thrash coming out of LA, San Francisco, and New York. And on the dance scene, you've got High Energy, which is coming out of London, New York, and San Francisco. And you've got the participants in these scenes flying back and forth or connecting through the mail by sending fanzines and cassettes to each other. Or getting in the van and driving across country and cross-pollinating that way. So this is a unique period where we're seeing these what I would call supra-regional scenes, where it's not like, say, the Tulsa sound that evolves in Tulsa in the early 60s and then later spreads out via LA and other places, or you have the New Orleans scene, which has its own distinct thing, or the Memphis scene or Chicago blues, where it would be in a city. Now suddenly communications has gotten cheap enough and powerful enough that you can have these these scenes that are scattered over a whole continent. So the early 80s was kind of, it was possible to do that. And you had these alternative weeklies and you had fanzines and magazines because you had no TV coverage of this stuff, none whatsoever. If you were into the new wave of British heavy metal and TV was your only source and mainstream publications, you maybe would get a little bit of news about Iron Maiden and Def Leppard and maybe a mention of Motorhead and Rolling Stone or Circus or something, but that would be it. You're not going to be hearing about Diamond Head. You're not going to be hearing about Venom. You're certainly not going to be hearing about Blitzkrieg or Tank or Raven or anything like that. So these guys were already plugging in into an alternative communications model, but because of all these fanzines and tape compilations and tape trading, they were able to do that. So yeah, it was a unique period in time. Yeah. Definitely won't see anything like that.
So I mean, like, it was kind of like the original sort of liberal idea of what college ought to be. Like, you had people from different areas with different influences, you know, traveling back and forth. And, you know, they're in, you know, other regions influence them when they'd go there, and they'd influence that region when they go there. I don't know if you could get music like that today, and I don't want to go all boomer and say the music of today sucks. That isn't my intention, but
yeah, it's just a different period, and we know that this, you know, the early 80s produced these phenomenons that we're still talking about, and it remains to be seen what, if anything, the 21st century is going to produce that's going to have that kind of staying power. But the regionalism. Now you're talking about micro-regionalism, and we can get that. But let's get back to let's stick to thrash,
sure,
and the beginning of Metallica. But Steph's telling me it's time to cue, and let's go ahead and play. This is Slayer's Aggressive Perfector demo from Metal Blade's Metal Massacre 3. This is Slayer, Aggressive Perfector. That was Slayer's Aggressive Perfector demo from Brian Slagle of Metal Blade's Metal Massacre 3. I don't know why I want to keep saying Medical Massacre 3 every time. But again, this is Slayer when they're in LA. They're still wearing
it's
makeup.
It's the Angel of Death influence.
Yeah. And they're painting their you know, they got the football ink under their eyes there for a little bit of not quite corpse paint, but more makeup than anybody else in the thrash scene had, although they pretty much gave that up the first time they played in San Francisco. But let's get back to Metallica a little bit. You had the original lineup coalesce. I'm glad you mentioned the original bass player. Was it Ron McCovey?
That Ron McGovney.
McGovney, which is such a Spinal Tap name. He sounds like somebody who got kicked out of the third lineup of Steppenwolf, you know, Goldie St. John or something like that. It's a classic rock and roll, also ran name. But
Heavy Metal's Pete Best.
Yeah. But they bring in Cliff Burton. And that's another thing I think that the Metal Evolution documentary didn't really get into, the importance of Cliff Burton, because not only was he, I mean, Lars Ulrich was kind of, I think I've read somebody say he was the logistical director of Metallica, like, you know, here's where we're going to be, here's what we're going to play, you know, here's what we're getting paid, here's the van. But Cliff Burton was the heart and soul of the music and the kind of the guiding spirit of Metallica. And if he gave something the thumbs down, it was out. And if he gave something the thumbs up, it was in. Virtuoso bass player and also classically trained. And that was one of the causes of tension with Dave Mustaine, was that Burton and Ulrich felt like he wasn't keeping up with their improvisations. And Kirk Hammett had been trained by Joe Satriani and had that. But that spurs Mustaine then into making Megadeth this super complicated, super jazz-influenced, very progressive.
Jazz-influenced because of Chris Poland.
Yeah, Chris Poland is definitely
the first guitarist. He was a jazz guy.
Yeah, a big part of it. But Mustaine's rhythms are really unique and jazzy. But also Mustaine's behavior and his incipient alcoholism and just his obnoxious personality was another factor. Like, as great as that lineup was, and Mustaine, you know, co-wrote, I think he got three or four writer credits on Kill 'Em All.
Four.
And some of the best songs. And obviously Megadeth put together a very impressive body of work, and you know, second only to Metallica or Slayer, I would say, in the thrash, you know, out of the thrash bands. So he was definitely this force to be reckoned with. And he even claims, you know, credit for Kerry King's style, because Kerry King was briefly in an early lineup of Megadeth, and Mustaine, certainly they influenced each other, cross-pollinated. So Mustaine's big brag is, you know, I was a big impact on three out of the four big four, you know, between Metallica, Megadeth, and Slayer, which I think is totally fair. But, you know, the Megadeth Metallica rivalry has been playing out for decades.
Still in the comment section of YouTube videos. Plays out today.
They just won't let it go. But the way the movie's structured, they run through the whole Metallica career. They talk about Kill 'Em All and then Ride the Lightning, Master Puppets. They don't make as big a deal out of the move to Elektra, which I think took effect for Ride the Lightning, and then Kill 'Em All was even re-released on Elektra in 84. But and the other thing to get across that I think,
you know, what's an odd coincidence about Elektra? Dave Mustaine's daughter is named Elektra.
Ironic. But he has to sign with capital.
There's a head guy, if I've ever seen one, right there.
But the thing about Metallica in the 80s, I don't think the Metal Evolution episode got across. And I don't, you know, is that they were an underground band throughout the 80s. It, you know, even though they were, you know, opening up for Ozzy on one of his big tours, that was kind of their big break. They didn't get on the radio at all, and they didn't have any videos until they put out the video for One when they did the Injustice for All album after Cliff Burton died in 1986. So, but in this period we're talking about, they are underground, even though they're building into this massively popular band. It's one of those things where, like, hardcore punk never got as big as Metallica, and it's like one of those, why not? And if you look at it specifically, well, it's because Black Flag got into a legal battle and couldn't record or play for 18 months. It's because the Bad Brains refused to sign with Elektra and kept breaking up and coming back, you know, refused to sign with Island, turned down their opportunity to open up for U2 on the Joshua Tree tour. You know, every band, there's a reason. Minor Threat broke up. But the movement as a whole doesn't, you know, get big until arguably Green Day or whatever, but thrash metal, because they're led by Metallica, who are just machines and are just out there on the road constantly. And even when Cliff Burton dies in a bus accident in 86, they
they're interviewing bassists like 6 months later.
Yeah, and bring in Jason Newsted and the Garage Days Revisited album, and then Injustice for All. So it doesn't really, you know, miss a step there. Although musically, they're never quite the same. I think for a lot of fans like me, after Master of Puppets, it's not ever quite the same band again. And that the,
how could it be?
Yeah, I mean, Cliff Burton was just an absolute musical force. But anyway, then the movie goes on to kind of focus on Dave Mustaine and Metallica. And he talks about, you know, being kicked out of Metallica inspired me to be better and faster than Metallica. But, you know, the dirty little secret was I was always better and faster than Metallica. So, you know, Mustaine never let go of the bitterness about that. And it just fueled his creativity. And, you know, despite his struggles with substance abuse and various lineup changes, Megadeth also just had a relentless career momentum and put out albums like Peace Sells But Who's Buying in 1986 that are widely seen as masterpieces. And, you know, Metallica goes on to massive breakthrough success with Injustice for All, and then even bigger with the Black Album that comes out basically at the same time as Nirvana's Nevermind. Megadeth has multiple multi-platinum albums in the 90s as well. So unlike many of the thrash bands or the thrash scene as a whole that sort of fades after the Clash of the Titans tour in 1991, Megadeth just keeps going and manages to hold.
And like, it was weird because I always felt that people didn't see the Metallica influence on Dave Mustaine, because, I mean, all the albums that he released up until Countdown to Extinction or through Countdown to Extinction were a response to Metallica albums. Metallica releases Kill 'Em All. He releases Killing Is My Business and Business Is Good. Very, you know, you think Kill 'Em All is good, I'll show them. Metallica releases Ride the Lightning. He releases Peace Sells. I mean, obviously, So Far, So Good, So What? Really can't compare to Master of Puppets. But Rust in Peace was very much an answer to the progressive technical masterpiece that was Injustice for All, and Countdown to Extinction was kind of his take on the more, you know, radio friendly heavy metal that the Black Album bought. And I mean, I really think without being kicked out of Metallica, I don't know if he has that songwriting career. You look at the guy, he's pretty erratic. He's got, you know, just about every self-destructive behavior you could think of. And, you know, without that motivation, without that just pure spite, I don't know if he reaches those heights.
Yeah, it's impossible to say, but he definitely is spurred on by his bitterness with Metallica. And also, I think you can very much tell he's not a natural vocalist, and that a lot of his vocal lines, I can hear James Hetfield singing those vocal lines and singing them better. and that's also one of the things going back and listening to all these early thrash albums that I haven't listened to on Moss in decades. It's very clear to me from the beginning that Metallica had a melodic edge to it and a songwriting edge to it that you can see where they grew into what they became. It was not some hard right turn. It was sort of an organic evolution. But let's take a quick break from our sponsors. When we come back, we'll talk about the rest of the Big Four.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
So then the movie moves back to LA and talks about the fact that even though glam is what we remember, you know, and associate with LA rock in the 80s, Motley Crue, Poison, et cetera, et cetera, there was still a very big scene, thrash scene in LA at the same time, mostly though in Orange County, not down in Hollywood, but out in the suburbs. That's where Slayer played. Slayer probably played in Hollywood once or twice, but they played in Orange County a ton. Also, you had, you know, Suicidal Tendencies out there. And Suicidal Tendencies is this really unusual band that comes out of the hardcore scene, was originally kind of ugly duckling of the hardcore scene. Like they were voted most likely to never succeed in Flipside or one of those mags 1 year. And the next year they're band of the year and most hated, I think. And we'll talk about this a little more. Suicidal cultivated these gang contacts, and there was a whole scene of people that you would call suicidals who emulated Suicidal Tendencies and had this vibe, and they would tend to fight with the hardcore guys and any of the other various. They were very much sort of like the straight edge gangs or the G.G. Allin emulators. There were these various sort of forces, and the Suicidals were one of those. And we'll talk about a big show in San Francisco, I think, in a minute. But then back to Slayer, you know, Slayer, heavy in Orange County, that they were an equal and opposite reaction to glam is how they're described in the movie. They wore makeup early on, but abandoned that as soon as they went up to San Francisco. And the Pits, that's the big difference between thrash and Nawabum, is that slam dancing comes over from punk and becomes part of the metal scene in San Francisco. And the Nawabum band guys, I mean, it was just a whole different kind of dude that insisted on bodily autonomy and did not want to be touched, and, you know, would fight you or stab you if you tried to slam dance with them. But by this point, a younger generation of metal fans is more open and into
more
it.
More in
and
touch with their feelings.
Yeah.
Or, you know, willing to hit a stranger with that's not wearing a shirt.
Yeah. And it becomes the most intense Pits going anywhere. And, you know, Slayer has another career arc where they start with Haunting the Chapel and Hella Waits, and then you get Rain and Blood in 1986. And they don't talk about Rick Rubin and Def Jam here, but Rick Rubin produces Rain and Blood and gets this amazing sound quality, lets them be as raw and visceral as they want, but, you know, just perfects the sound. So it's just this
sounds professional sound.
Yeah.
And it's professional.
Just this incredible album, and Rain and Blood's probably the platonic ideal of thrash, and you know, it gets them bigger. But then they move, segue to the San Francisco scene. They cut to Kirk Hammett.
You're just gonna let that go. You're gonna let go that you don't find it ironic that someone with how should I put this? Kerry King's hobbies is from Orange County. I mean, there's just that other little influence there. And you mentioned Ruben, like that was always like Gary King's out. He's like, hey, look, you know, my producer's Rick Rubin. Like, you're gonna call me a Nazi, you know, Tom Araya, my lead singer, he's Catholic, you know, we sing about Satan and stuff. Like, it's just an act. And yeah, like, I mean, I don't know how many Slayer shows you've been to, but okay, yeah, I think I've been to 5, but I mean, they're all much after you started going.
Yes, so I'm in 88 for the first time with Motorhead and Overkill, and it was just an absolute religious conversion experience. Then I saw them with Stryper in what I would say mercy killing, but there was no mercy to it. I'm just torturing. I was like putting a pin through a butterfly, and then saw a couple more times.
Did it look like the January 6th riots back then, or is that was that sort of a newer?
That was a newer twist, but it definitely had a perpetrator and victim feel to it. The very few Stryper fans in the audience were fleeing for their lives in short order. Just craziness. And yeah, Ugliness, you know, Rain and Blood opens up with Angel of Death, which is about Mengele and Auschwitz, and you know, it's been controversial.
The opening line is Auschwitz, the meaning of pain, the way that I want you to die.
Yeah, but they're speaking in character, and you know, you can make horror movies from the point of view of a serial killer, and people don't blame you for that. So that's the latitude musicians want. But
that's like, to his point, I mean, he said, he's like, you know, I mean, I don't know what your language restrictions are, but he said, you know, hey, what's more effed up than that? And you know, that is a good question.
Yeah, they were dealing in an environment where Venom had come out. You know, Black Sabbath's attitude was always like, we dabbled in the occult and we're sure sorry and we're scared and we learned our lesson and look at our crucifixes. Venom was like openly, we're satanic, but with kind of a wink and a nod, because the whole thing had a certain, you know, clown car feeling that you could tell it was a bit of a put on. But with the Slayer, it was harder to tell it was a put on, and the intensity level was torqued up, although they were never openly Satanists. You know, it's not until you get to death metal that you get into openly satanic bands again after Venom. But let's keep going and move to San Francisco. Like, Kirk Hammett is on the documentary saying, yeah, Metallica's from LA, but the reality is they got kicked out of LA. They came to San Francisco and they came alive. Plus, you had Exodus, which was Kirk Hammett's original band, plus Death Angel, Testament, Violence, Heathen, Forbidden, also Possessed, which many people consider the first death metal band. And that's one thing I also think it's important to keep in mind here, is that bands like Venom and Possessed and Bathory and Celtic Frost and others that are seen in retrospect as part of other scenes, the death metal or black metal scenes, at the time were seen as part of the extreme. You know, you just had extreme metal and we didn't know if it was called thrash metal or speed metal. You knew there was something different than what had come before, but still, you know, even something like Man of War, which we now say is power metal, at the time was just super extreme heavy metal and was coming, you buy them in the same record stores, you see them on the same bills. So there's a lot of cross-pollination between these sort of emergent scenes. But the key thing about San Francisco, I think, is that you had these clubs like the old Waldorf Club and Ruthie's Inn, and it became a true scene where you might go out to see Death Angel, but Metallica is going to be in the crowd and Exodus is going to be in the crowd. And at the end of the night, Testament's there and you're going to go back to Metallica's house and party. So it's a true scene in the sort of Beatles in the Cavern Club in Hamburg with Jerry and the Pacemakers hanging out. It's very much that kind of cross-pollination. And Exodus is a band that is just outside the Big Four, and for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is Kirk Hammett getting poached by Metallica, but also because you had this basically unaccountable delay. If you actually read the history of Exodus, there are reasons why their first album didn't come out until 1985. But the reality is they could have had at least a major demo out by 83, 84. Definitely should have had their album out by 84. But Bond in the Blood doesn't come out till 85. And then when it does come out and they tour, they immediately fire their singer, Paul Baloff, who's this legendary metalhead and just sort of embodied kind of the John Belushi of thrash metal, just embodied the vibe. You know, like Gary Holt, who's the mainstay of Exodus, said, you know, Blaylock's love for metal was undeniable. He might forget lyrics, he'd come in out of time, but he terrified the posers. And that's another thing, like, these guys love to beat up glam metal guys. But this musical chairs thing continues, and after they fire Blaylock, then they go and poach Testament's singer Zetro Souza. So, you know, which sets that Testament back, and they ultimately get their definitive singer.
Chuck Billy.
Yeah, Chuck Billy. But again, it causes these delays. And I think that that's one of the factors that keeps Exodus and Testament out of the quote unquote big four. And then they focus in on the fans, which is a key part. But Steph tells me it's time to cue. And perfect. Let's hear Exodus Bonded by Blood. This is with Paul Blaylock. Was Bonded by Blood by Exodus off their first album Bonded by Blood, featuring the late great Paul Blaylock on vocals. And you can hear the virtues and the limitations of Blaylock and why they would possibly want to fire him for more than just personal reasons. He had a pretty limited voice as well, and all these bands, there's definitely a prog factor aspect to all these bands, where, and I think it's just coming from Metallica, because you had Cliff Burton and Kirk Hammett, who were into these more complicated melodic ideas, and you know, obviously Hammett and Ulrich Hetfield and Ulrich were into these complicated structures as well. So when you talk about the history of prog metal, I think you have to include Metallica. I think you have to include all of thrash pretty much, because they were definitely playing with ideas that came out of the prog scene. But let's get back to the fans and talk about it, because this, again, like, metal was so dominant in the 80s. I don't think it's possible for people to comprehend now that metal and rock in the 80s were pretty synonymous, even though you had the punk scene and hardcore punk and the nascent indie punk scene, you know, Husker Du and The Replacements and et cetera, Meat Puppets and those bands that were coming out of the hardcore scene but moving in more of a, you know, alternative indie pop direction. You had that, and you also had like the sort of Bruce Springsteen Heartland rocker bands, which thankfully never caught on. But you had a ton of bands that wanted to be the next generation.
Bruce Springsteen is still selling out stadiums.
Springsteen, yeah, but I'm talking about the bands influenced by him, like the Del Fuegos and et cetera, the Beaver Brown Band and all these kind of bands. But other than that, if you're a rock band, you are pretty much a metal band in the 80s. And so even there's even some back and forth between the glam and the thrash scenes that we see in retrospect as totally separate. But you look at a band like Pantera that literally evolved through all of it, and just shows that, you know, the scene was connected. But the thing about thrash was they had the most dedicated fans. They were overwhelmingly dudes. The chicks were more into the glam scene. And so, you know, as good sexist rockists, we disapprove of that. And we love the scenes that are all dudes and all testosterone. And the thrash fans were extremely dedicated. They were ordering the records to the mail. Go ahead.
Who had better mascara tips than Vince Neil?
It's true. You know, and
that is not a homophobic or sexist joke. That is a Motley Crue joke, by the way.
Yes. Yes. And there's nothing, you know, that you got to admire the mascara game they had. But the, you know, the thrashing was intense. They perfected the heavy metal dress code, the jeans jacket vest over the leather jacket with all the patches and the band buttons and the big rocker of your favorite album on the back, you know, and you'd wear the white sneakers and the tight jeans, studs on your wristband and maybe your belt, you know, baseball sleeve shirts, long hairs,
chain wallet.
Yeah, chain wallet, definitely. And then, you know, and the shows themselves were like a football game or a wrestling match. I mean, the stage diving and headbanging and moshing. Lots of kids got hurt. Plenty of people got crippled for life. But Many people didn't, you know, and that was kind of the trade-off. And then they've got a great quote from Creator. He says, of course, the fans love you and they're totally faithful, but if you release a shitty record, they will tell you. And that's absolutely,
very true.
Absolutely true. You know, and then the movie moves over to the New York scene and talks about, you know, you had Anthrax, Nuclear Assault, Stormtroopers of Death, later MOD, and also this overlap with the New York City hardcore scene, and, you know, the Bad Brains had moved from DC to New York, and kind of Johnny Appleseed did this whole scene with bands like Agnostic Front and Reagan Youth and later on Biohazard and you know, a ton of bands out of New York that becomes kind of a mainstay of crossover punk metal in the later 80s and on into the 90s. But early in the 80s, you already had what they called the Old Bridge Militia, which is this super hardcore fan base. You had tons of fans out of Jersey, also big contingents out of Queens and Brooklyn and Staten Island. And bands like Slayer and Metallica would come and stay spend weeks or months staying at either the Megaforce house or the Old Bridge Militia house and playing and, you know, having people take them in when they were broke and had nowhere else to go. And you had the L'Amour clubs. You had one in Brooklyn and one in Queens that were having weekly shows, playing this kind of heavy rock. You also had the 516 club where you had a DJ night, playing metal records, which just like in London, where they had DJ clubs, but they would have the PA set up different, more like stacks of Marshalls. And so the sound was more like what you'd get from a rock band, rather than, you know, the kind of sound system you might have at the Paradise Garage or the Warehouse in Chicago. So it's a different thing, but it gets that modern sound system DJ power into the metal scene. And then they come to Anthrax and they talk about that the main thing that's different about East Coast thrash is that people like Joey Belladonna, the vocalist for Anthrax, were melodic singers, and they always sang rather than growling or roaring like most of the thrash singers. So that was kind of the unique thing. Also, Anthrax was very self-conscious about being connected to the punk scene and being influenced by the punk scene, and then later on about being influenced by the rap scene. And of course, they go on to pioneer rap rock in collaboration with Public Enemy. Actually, the I'm the Man EP comes out before that, you know, and that was a big thing. That opened up a lot of metalheads to rap. I know my metal friends, once Anthrax gave it the sign off, then they were a lot more open to Run DMC or the Beastie Boys.
How did that kind of compare with Walk This Way?
Because
I forget they had just an Aerosmith version, the Run DMC version.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Run DMC Aerosmith collaboration, I think for a lot of people, kind of came out of nowhere. You saw it on MTV first, and it was hard, I think, for people to fully get what was going on. I mean, everybody liked it as a popular record, or, you know, not everybody liked it, but it was popular. People liked it, but it didn't have any context unless you knew the history of Run DMC. But if you're a rock fan, you're just seeing, who are these rappers and why are they working with Aerosmith? Whereas with Anthrax, I'm the Man, initially a lot of people, I think, thought that they were making fun of rap rather than having fun with rap. But by the time they're collaborating with Public Enemy, it was just interesting to watch that evolution, because the people I knew that were hardcore metalheads and hardcore Anthrax fans memorized every word of the I'm the Man EP and could do that rapping. And then you'd check back in with them and they'd be at a party sing along with the Beastie Boys' Fight for Your Right to Party or Tone Loc's Wild Thing, just like everybody else. Then maybe a few, you know, by the time the Anthrax Public Enemy collaboration comes out, these guys are blasting Public Enemy and NWA in their tape decks in their cars. So it's kind of an evolutionary thing, but I think Anthrax deserves a lot of credit for helping spread hip hop into, you know, the white suburban metalhead demo.
Well, it was just kind of a super underrated band generally. I mean, they're sort of, I went to the Big Four tour at Yankee Stadium. Anthrax was, I mean,
you're talking about Clash of the Titans?
No. Anthrax, Megadeth, Slayer, and Metallica. They played at Yankee Stadium.
What year is this?
2011.
Wow.
It was like this big thing. They had a tour. They played in Indio or whatever the Coachella city is. I think it's Indio.
Yeah.
One of those California places. And they had a European tour at a DVD. But when they played the stadium, your Yankee Stadium, I went. And I mean, Anthrax, they got kind of the hero's welcome. They, obviously, like none of those old places, Labor's, CBGB's, et cetera, some New York dickhead landlord kicked those clubs out long ages ago. But I think like the mayor of the Bronx or whatever, the borough president, I'm not quite sure how those Yankees do things up there. They got an Anthrax Day. I think it was like September 13th. Because I remember it was also the 10-year anniversary of 9/11. Huh. It was just around that. And we were talking about earlier that San Francisco wasn't always San Francisco, but New York was kind of always New York. I mean, even when it was just, you know, sort of a Dutch immigrant hub, it was still kind of like always New York City. And, you know, like, I just wonder if being there, being in sort of that and in a hub like that is what shaped Anthrax a little bit differently from, you know, Megadeth, Slayer, and Metallica.
I definitely think that was a factor. And also because New York was such a punk city. I mean, it's easy to forget that New York had a rock scene in the 60s, but actually Steph's telling me it's time to cue. So let me cue our last track. This is Suicidal Tendencies, Suicidal Maniac from their Join the Army album. And that was Suicidal Tendencies, Suicidal Maniac from the Join the Army album. And this is Crossover. We'll talk about Crossover in a second, but let's finish up the Anthrax. Yeah, I definitely agree that the New York City aspect made them more cosmopolitan and more open-minded than maybe some of the LA and San Francisco bands were. Although those were fairly open-minded, at least to the punk side of stuff.
Sure.
But not to the rap side of stuff, not in the same way, at least not in the same, and basically never. I mean, Metallica was notoriously resistant to having Ice-T's body count on the bill with them and Guns N' Roses and that ill-fated tour in the early 90s. But yeah, I think Anthrax coming out of New York where CBGBs and the Ramones were such a big thing, and also the Bad Brains and the New York hardcore scene was such a big thing. They had to be more open-minded and more respectful. And also you couldn't miss hip hop in New York in the 80s. But one thing that people forget, I think, is that New York does have a rock and roll history. In the late 60s, you had bands like the Rascals and Vanilla Fudge that were on Atlantic and had big influence and big impact at the time, but never quite produced anything to compete with like what San Francisco or Detroit put out in the late 60s, you know, with the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane or the Stooges and MC5 and you know, Ted Nugent and Grand Funk Railroad and all that stuff coming out of the Midwest. Also, Alex Cooper was messed up in that scene. But now let's talk about Crossover, because Crossover, you know, hardcore kind of comes into the story at two points. First is an influence, although kind of a on the down low influence, at least at first. It's not really until Metallica's Garage Days Revisited EP comes out, where they've got covers not just of Diamond Head, but also of The Misfits and Killing Joke, where they're showing their influences on their sleeve. And of course, Jeff Hanneman of Slayer was big on, you know, flying his Dead Kennedys flag and his Dead Kennedys stickers and his Black Flag Bars stickers on things as well. So people knew that these thrash bands were influenced by punk. And you had, you know, Stormtroopers of Death, which is basically Anthrax with a different singer doing a crossover punk album. But around this time, you had a bunch of punk bands, particularly DRI, Dirty Rotten Imbeciles, and COC, Corrosion of Conformity, coming out of Texas and the Carolinas respectively. And they openly start becoming more metal bands. And Suicidal Tendencies, which had been the most commercially successful hardcore band with their institutionalized hit single that was on MTV and on the Repo Man soundtrack and everything, they cross over completely with Join the Army. And the metal bands kind of meet them in the middle. And so you get shows like this Anthrax, D-R-I-C-O-C, Possessed show at the Olympic Auditorium in L.A., 3,000 fans. And, you know, I think it was Scott Ian that described it as you had skinheads versus punks versus suicidals versus metalheads versus bikers. All of these groups are in there. They're all macho. They're all willing and ready to fight, and they're all fighting with each other. At one, you know, there's five pits going at one time. The show is ultimately stopped when there's a brawl on stage between bikers and suicidals. Some kid gets his head cracked up with a mic stand, and they, you know, have to shut the whole thing down. But so initially, it's, I think, a testament to the power of the music and the cultural stuff going on that there's this much violence associated with it, and people are taking their scenes so seriously. In just a few years, it's not going to be any big deal for metal fans to go to a punk show or punk fans to go to a metal show. And, you know, this kind of, if we can walk together, why can't we rock together thing gets solved. But in the mid to late 80s, it's very much a live, controversial issue. And so bands like Suicidal Tendencies and Anthrax on the other side are kind of doing the Lord's work and bringing people together. And another thing about Suicidal Tendencies to keep in mind is that they, you know, Mike Moore, the lead singer, was very much coming out of the Chicano scene in LA and that kind of gang culture. And then you had Rocky George, their second guitar player, joins in the band in time for Join the Army, who's African American. And so, you know, shows a lot. This isn't as a lily white a scene as you might think. And, you know, those guys are part of it. And then the
Chuck
last thing
was Native American too.
Yes. Yeah. And definitely. And Death Angel also, those guys are Hispanic as well. And then they kind of talk about the touring life and how basically a few of the bands, Metallica being the biggest one, obviously, but also Megadeth and Anthrax and Slayer, go on to this sort of rock star level of success. But the bands who didn't make that eventually kind of ran into the ground with, you know, you toured themselves into the ground. The scene had a limited size. Alternative metal and grunge kind of come along in the late 80s and early 90s and push it aside. Death metal and black metal and the metal underground kind of push it aside. And, you know, they talk about the cost of it. Obviously, Cliff Burton dying in a bus accident in 86. But you also had Death Angel, where no one was killed, but they had a bus wreck, multiple injuries. That's why they weren't on the Clash of the Titans tour. You know, Paul Blaylock ultimately dies of a stroke long after he's fired from Exodus. Bobby Blitz of Overkill has a seizure on stage in 2002. So just a hard
James lifestyle. James Hetfield got set on fire.
Yes.
By Pyro, too.
Yep. So all these guys are paying. But the last thing I want to mention is this international aspect in the European scene, because bands like Creator and Sodom and Destruction in Germany are a big part of the scene. American fans are listening to those bands. And more importantly, I think American bands are going over to Germany and playing for the by far the largest audiences of their careers. And it makes this an international scene. And then by the time you get, you know, bands like the Swiss contingent, like Celtic Frost and Corner, you know, you had Voivod in Canada, and then you've got like Sepultura and Sarcophago in Brazil. So it becomes this international, truly global scene. And that's a big part of it. Anything you want to add about the European thrash?
Oh, not really. The European metal I liked was always the more new album influences. Creator was, I got into Creator a little bit later in life, but most of the, I don't know, because like I always think of thrash as like an American genre, and not to be overly nationalistic, but I feel like that was kind of like the United States' first contribution to heavy metal. And I just always associated with American.
I wouldn't say it was the first contribution because, you know, you got bands like Steppenwolf and Blue Cheer and the Stooges and MC5 and, you know, et cetera, Aerosmith. But I think what it was thrash was the moment when the American band seized the flag, or they were the world champions of heavy metal for the first time. Because no matter how great Steppenwolf or MC5 was, there was always Black Sabbath or Led Zeppelin or Deep Purple over in England. And in the late 70s, it was always Judas Priest or Iron Maiden or Motorhead. You know, like, England had been setting the standard for metal, and after the 80s that just wasn't the case. And we'll talk about some of there's still a few more English contributions to come, but yeah, you're never gonna again see the flag of metal. The kings of metal are never going to come out of England again. From now on, it's going to be kind of between the States and Europe, going back and forth and fighting. And then we talked about the Clash of the Titans tour on the Metal Evolution episode, but again, that's the kind of the capstone of thrash metal. 1991, Anthrax, Slayer, and Megadeth go out on tour. They take Alice in Chains, who are not yet known, out as their opening act, and they're playing like Madison Square Garden, another 15,000 to 20,000 seater arenas. And at the same time, Metallica's Black Album comes out, and they cross over. And essentially, I really think the Black Album is a grunge album and was part of the grunge revolution in 91. I mean, you're at that time on MTV, you're hearing Nirvana and Metallica back to back on MTV over and over again. Pearl Jam, Metallica, Alice in Chains, Metallica, you know, and they caught on and moved on in a way into the 90s that Anthrax definitely struggled in the 90s. Slayer definitely struggles after they fire Dave Lombardo, and they kind of have a moment in the wilderness, and they never really try to accommodate grunge, although they do sadly try to accommodate new metal later on. And like we mentioned, Megadeth did accommodate these trends quite successfully. But thrash, basically, after the Clash of the Titans, is a past movement. But the last thing we should bring up is Pantera, who start out as a Van Halen-style hair band. By Cowboys from Hell, they're a thrash band. And by Vulgar Display of Power, they're this new thing. Retroactively, we call groove metal. They were clearly influenced by bands like Helmet and other, you know, noise rock and alt metal bands, and brought new aspects into it. But Pantera is the one unabashedly metal band that is popular through the whole grunge era. Any quick comments on Pantera?
I just wanted to riff more on like the thrash metal groove metal thing, because like I always considered them just straight groove metal. I never really associated them with thrash. Like their riff patterns were always more, I mean like all rock and roll is bluesy, but they seem to like turn up the gain on the blues side of the dial. And whereas I don't know, thrash, I always felt just more of a classical influence.
Yeah, they're definitely different, and we'll do a whole episode on Pantera here coming up and talk about that. But at the time, especially like when Cowboys from Hell came out in 1990, there wasn't anything like groove metal is still a pretty nebulous concept, which basically means Pantera and people who sound like them. I mean, there's not like a huge number of groove metal bands. So at the time when Cowboys from Hell came out, it was kind of like, hey, check this out. And I'm like, Pantera, they're a corny hair band. And somebody's like, no, man, they've gone thrash. And so that was kind of the context we had to see it in. But at the same time, keep in mind that things like Seven Churches by Possessed, which is now seen as the first death metal album, when that came out, it was just another thrash band. It was a weird one, but we saw it in the context of thrash. Same thing with Celtic Frost or Bathory, things that we now see as black metal were seen as thrash because that was kind of the only bag to put it in. So anyway,
so where do you consider Death? The band Death.
Definitely the Florida band Death, not the Detroit 70s band Death, but the Florida band Death is definitely death metal. But like I said, their first albums, their first cassette I first saw, I had a buddy who worked in a record store and had all the new stuff. He had that in there right next to Death Angel, you know, and it was just like another, looking at the cover and everything, it obviously was a little different because it had the whole iconography that we now recognize as death metal. Something stuck out about it, but at the time it we didn't have a vocabulary. I didn't know what death metal was. So I just considered it as an interesting variant of thrash at the time. So these trends are kind of imposed retroactively. And at the time, those records were sold in the same, they were sorted in the same section of the record stores. They were sold in the same record stores. They were playing the same clubs, you know, so the lines were not that stark. But any final thoughts on Get Thrashed, Chris?
That was an interesting documentary. Always happy to talk thrash metal. I mean, obviously one of the, probably the most successful heavy metal subgenre. Produced the biggest metal band ever, and I'm happy you had me on.
Yeah, well, happy to have you here, and we're going to come back. We're going to continue the Metal Evolution series. The grunge episode is coming up next, but I really think we need to talk about crossover and alternative metal, and by that I mean things like Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jane's Addiction, Living Color, Fishbone, Faith No More. There's just a whole subset of stuff that is going to become big influences on nu metal, but also noise rock bands like Helmet and Jesus Lizard. There was a whole lot going on in the late 80s, early 90s before that Nirvana was actually part of. And I want to kind of talk about that pre thing. So I think that's going to be the next thing. So for Nate Wilcox and Chris Duncan, we've been talking heavy metal.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate welcomes Chris Duncan back for another Let Metal Roll episode focused on grunge bands The Melvins and Tad. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.